history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories by the people who live around you that we need to hear. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We meet some interesting characters, and we're educated, we're entertained, and oftentimes inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, we're going to meet a 93-year-old who was part of something top secret during World War II. These days, you can find him on the dance floor. How good a dancer are you, Bob?
I've been considered by some professionals as looking like a professional. Being very modest, let's put it this way. I just love to dance. I don't care how good I am as long as my partner's happy.
Good answer. Good answer. You can tell we're in for a fun ride today with Bob Allenby, 93 years old, of Newman, California. Now, I know where Newman is because I grew up in Los Banos, about 30 miles away. But tell the rest of our listeners, where in the world is Newman, California?
That's what everybody asks me. And sometimes I get confused. But if you go up I-5, turn off on 33 at Santanella, and go 10 miles... you will be in Gustine, and then go another 4 miles, and you'll be in that huge metropolis of Newman, all 5,215 of us.
Wow, he even knows the population. That's impressive. But originally, you're from somewhere further north of that, Ukiah, California. So growing up there in the 1930s, what was life like as a boy in Ukiah?
Well, I'll put it this way. We lived on a farm north of Ukiah, California. And this was in the 30s. And life was simple, isolated, and we always had, of course, this was during the Depression, we never went without butter, milk, all kinds of vegetables. We had our own chickens, we had our own pigs, we had bacon and eggs and ham. We raised corn to sell, Blue Lake string beans, and we raised pears. And because the life was so boring in Ukiah, California, for a 13-year-old, I requested to live in San Bruno, California, with my mother, who then moved to Palo Alto, California. Big life change, believe me.
Well, yeah, so you end up going to Palo Alto High School, which some folks may know is right across the street, literally, from Stanford University. That must have been an interesting place to be.
Well, I have to be perfectly frank. And I say this to encourage people that might be in the same situation I was. I came from a little town high school, freshman, to Palo Alto College Prep High School across the street from Stanford University. I felt lost. Quit school, went to work for the Western Union, met my future wife, who was 13, and I was 15. And that's how my life started to where I am now.
Wow. And who knew the twists and turns it was going to take in the years right ahead of that? I like to ask every veteran this question because everybody seems to remember. But December 7th, 1941, do you remember how you found out what happened that day?
I certainly do, because my future wife and I were together in Palo Alto, and we heard it on the radio and couldn't believe it. And then we believed it because, ladies and gentlemen, every light on the peninsula went out at our first air raid alert.
And a lot of people don't realize that. We're so used to the way things are now. But you're talking about the San Francisco area, the entire Bay Area. There's an air raid siren, and you have to turn out the lights and hope you're not getting bombed.
That's it. Between San Francisco and San Jose in those days, each town was separated by apricot orchards and cherry orchards and things of that sort. Every city had an air raid siren, which was the fire department. And I don't know, and all the headlights on cars were then became slits, and that's the only way you could drive at night. And these air raid sirens went off time after time after time because we were constantly on alert because nobody knew what the Japanese had in mind, and we did not know whether they were off the coast of California ready to invade the continental United States. It was fear everywhere because of the unknown, and as a teenager, redirected my life instantly.
How did that happen? How long did you wait before you entered the military?
This happened in 1941, and I joined in 1942 when I was 18 years old. And I joined in San Francisco, California. Of course, this changed my life forever. And I would like to say this to young people. I had a minimal education, but throughout my years in the United States Navy, I received an incredible education in many fields. Every young person should consider the possibilities.
And I've talked to a lot of guys who are getting ready to go over and had to make a decision. Well, do I ask my girlfriend to marry me now, or do I wait to make sure I come back? And you had that decision to make too, I guess.
Well, that's interesting because I went to boot camp in Farragut, Idaho. And then when I graduated from that, I went to Norman, Oklahoma, to Aircraft Mechanics School. After I graduated from there, I had my first leave and went to Menlo Park, California, where my girlfriend, my future wife, was living. 4 days before I was to return, we were walking down Mill Street in Menlo Park, and my wife, my future wife, Virginia, said, "Honey, let's get married." Well, the shock, I still can't believe. Anyway, we only had 4 days in Belize. This is wartime. We had to get our license over in Alameda, California. You had to go through physical tests at that time in order to get a license. We got our license the day before I was to return in Alameda. I was married at the Naval Air Station Chapel, Alameda, California, at 7 o'clock, July the 29th, 1943. That's how it all started.
And did you have an idea of what you were going to be doing in the Navy?
I really didn't, and this is one of the things about wartime. You never know what's coming up next. And I was transferred when I went back to Norman, Oklahoma, to this most secret squadron in Clinton, Oklahoma, a very, very isolated small town in a panhandle of Oklahoma. And it was a squadron that was experimenting with radio-controlled drones. And we used NBCs as our motherships and SNJs as our drones with pilots in it. This is where my future was determined. The first time I took a flight in the air, I decided I had to be an air crewman or had to be in the air. And because of lack of education, I couldn't be a pilot, but I could sure be an air crewman.
Because to this point, you're a mechanic?
Yes, I was graduated from aircraft mechanic school, so I was an aircraft mechanic.
But you get that first taste of flying. What were you in? What was the plane you were in?
The plane I was in was an SNJ, and that was a Navy trainer plane at the time. It was a drone at that time, where we used to fly about 50 feet off the ground, and the mothership, the SNB, would control us. And it was rather hazardous. We lost a couple of them due to malfunctions.
Well, yeah, people, I think, are scratching their heads right now. They're saying, drones? Aren't those little things kids are flying around with cameras in them? Because this is the 1940s you're talking about. And most people listening, I'm sure, don't even realize that radio-controlled technology was around then, that you could even do this. But you're out there risking your life for it, is what you're telling me.
Absolutely. You have to remember that in those days, radio-controlled was not electronic as much as it was hydraulic. They had a signal go from the mother plane to the drone, but the controls were all hydraulically operated, which means they were very rough. Now, I lost my best friend due to an accident. He was riding in the drone. But the drones that went overseas and did the work for us later on had two like homing engines, carried a torpedo, and where mothership was then a B-24 and controlled it for miles and miles away, and it worked beautifully, and they never lost the man in the Pacific.
Well, because they learned how not to in the training days in Oklahoma that you're telling us about, and I'm trying to make this add up here. On one hand, you're telling me that you were a guinea pig in a plane that you didn't have control of, but somebody in another plane did. You're completely at their mercy. And on the other hand, you're telling me it was so much fun, you had to keep flying. So which is it? Were you about to die or having the time of your life?
Well, you have to understand this is a wonderful thing about being young. You know darn well you're indestructible. Nothing's ever going to happen to you. Yes, we took our lives in our hands every time we got in that drone because we were only about 50 feet off the ground flying along Oklahoma. And like they say, we lost planes. But I never thought about that, and nobody else did. And that's one reason mostly young people go to war, because they feel nothing's ever going to happen to them. They are going to be the exception to the rule.
And what were you guys doing inside the drone? Why was it necessary for you to be in there?
Well, it was necessary, not as a passenger, because I rode as a passenger, but it was necessary to have a pilot in it, because if there was an error, he could help control and save the plane from crashing. The radio control planes in those days, being hydraulic, everything fluttered. It was not smooth, so all the controls were fluttering back and forth. It was a rough ride. If they pushed the control on the mothership and things malfunctioned, the pilot had to be quick enough to save that plane. And they did 99% of the time, but not every time.
So what happened with your friend, and how did you process that at the time?
Well, I only heard about it after it happened, and the plane crashed in the prairies out there in Oklahoma. And to this day, the only thing I have to remind me of it is I have a piece of his burned parachute, because both he and the pilot were killed. The plane caught fire, of course. That's when we woke up to the fact that, yes, we're all vulnerable, but it didn't scare us enough to keep us out of the plane. Let's face it, I'm indestructible.
Yeah, but on the other hand, there's 406,000 Americans who died in World War II, and when we talk about that, we think they died in North Africa or Italy or France or Germany or Japan or, you know, the Pacific Islands. We don't think about Oklahoma, but there were a lot of servicemen who died before they ever went overseas.
A lot of people don't realize how many Americans were lost during the World War II due to accidents. In fact, they had a greater loss of accidents in the air than they did from combat due to accidents. But that's one thing about air crewmen. Anybody that served in the air in any service was paid a higher rate of pay than any other because of the extra hazard of it.
You told us about these drones and working with them in the testing process, but can you explain to us the idea behind it, how the drone was supposed to work in a combat situation?
Yes, the whole idea was to save lives. If you will think about it, the biggest loss of lives in the air in the Navy was SBD torpedo bombers, dive bombers, TBMs, and in one attack, the first attack that the Americans made on Japanese aircraft carriers with TBMs and SBDs, every single pilot was lost except one. And the whole idea of the drone was to send a pilotless, manless instrument of destruction to the enemy that could not be shot down as easily as a manned airplane. Lower, faster, more destructive. And that was the whole idea, to save lives.
And when we hear about drones today, and drones are becoming a much more prominent element of our armed forces, and we have pilots sitting around America right now who are controlling drones all over the world, and those drones will go in and take somebody out and fly back. But you're talking about a drone that's on a one-way mission, right?
Yes. In fact, there's a news article, and they used to call it American kamikaze pilots. And the difference is our kamikaze planes were pilotless, and the man piloting that kamikaze plane, that drone, was 50 miles away at 20 or 30,000 feet controlling this plane diving into a battleship. And in Europe, they used it to fly into the submarine pens, and that's the way they destroyed them, but flying into the same way with over in Japan, sinking the ships. So there were no personnel involved.
How did they aim, and how did they hit their target?
They aimed strictly by visual. We had radar in those days, very crude, but we could use radar to see an object flying, and the mothership would use visual as well as radar to guide the drone into the enemy's target. The thing you have to remember, in those days, we could not go up and down and backwards and sideways. It was all forward. They had two Lycoming engines. They would travel a couple hundred miles an hour, and they were a regular size plane. And of course, they're very destructive because they carried torpedoes and huge bombs.
Now, when you said 50 miles away, I'm assuming, well, they can't see where that drone is hitting the target.
But they had to do something that far away, it would be strictly by radar. But yeah, 9 out of 10 times, they could do it visually, because by the time the drones became operative in the Pacific, we were pretty much in control of the air, and we could fly very closely to the enemy without danger.
But the idea was to crash this explosive-laden plane into an enemy ship or position.
Exactly. The whole thing was just like the kamikaze pilots the Japanese used. They crashed the plane into the target. That was the way that we destroyed many, many, many enemy ships and never lost a man in the Pacific.
And you can talk about it now, but back then, you couldn't even tell your wife, probably.
Nobody in the world except the people in Squadron 6 knew that this squadron existed until it was either 13 or 16 years after the war was over. The United States government never released any information that this squadron existed. That's how secret it was.
So let me ask you, have you ever been called a liar by telling people about this squadron because they didn't believe that it existed?
I really have told very, very few people about this squadron until right now, because I never found anybody that would understand what I was talking about. And until recently, not too many people are interested unless you're talking to the right person, which I am now, of course. But I never talked to anybody about it. This is the first time I've been able to explain it. I'm proud of it, although I wasn't part of it when it was over in the battle zone. I was part of it in Clinton, Oklahoma, and that's pride enough for me.
As well you should be. It's break time, but when we come back, we'll find out what Bob was doing in PBMs in the Pacific with VPB-20. We'll hear it in his 2017 voice, but also in his World War II voice, thanks to a recording the Navy made all those years ago.
Bob Allenby, aviation machinist, mate, third class, United States Navy.
Now, how long have you been in the Navy, Bob?
3 years.
Tell us what you do out here in the Pacific.
I'm flying in a PBM Martin Mariner patrol squadron.
Also, what was it like to fly through a typhoon, and which famous Hollywood star did he hitch a ride from on Okinawa? Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.